Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We already feel isolated enough. Like, we've already got something going on that we don't really feel like we can share. Mm-hmm. But if we have people saying, actually, you know, like, give me the nitty-gritty of it, yeah, you know, let's not beat around the bush here, it makes you feel so much better.
Well, welcome everyone to the LuxGen Challenges podcast, a new podcast where we are going to be chatting to people about the challenges that they faced in their lives, be it loss, disabilities, trauma, mental health struggles, and most importantly, how they've overcome them and what they've learned along the way. We're really excited to take this chance to shed a light on these topics and give a space for resilient young people to share their stories of overcoming adversity and help others going through a tough time. Just before we get into it, we wanted to give a slight trigger warning because we're going to be discussing grief and loss and a specific accident with a slightly more graphic nature. So just a trigger warning in case that is going to upset anyone. But yeah, let's get into it. For this first episode, I'm really excited to introduce you all to Amber, who you guys probably know from the vlogs.
Yeah.
But she is part of the Sheer Lux and LuxGen team. She's been through various things throughout her life, from grief and loss to disabilities that she deals with every day. So today, we thought it would make a lot of sense to start off with Amber's story and explain why this podcast is so important to her before she takes the helm and starts speaking to other people. So, Amber, welcome.
Thank you. How
are you doing?
I'm good.
Well, we're going to start off by if you could tell us a little bit about mm-hmm. yourself, just to kind of kick us off and what we're doing here.
Yeah, of course. So I think it's fair to say I've definitely gone through my fair share of things in life so far. I have a visual impairment that comes from my albinism, as you can tell from the blonde hair. But for ages, I thought, you know, those are my cards in life. I have a disability. I can learn to cope with it and adapt to it. And then, you know, another curveball came my way when my family and I had a speedboat accident, which, yeah, changed my life forever and kind of has taken me on this amazing journey of learning about resilience and how to overcome adversity.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, this is the main reason of why Amber's the perfect person to be doing this podcast. She's been through a lot and we're going to touch on all of this a lot more in a moment. But before we start, I mean, you kind of answered that with your answer there, but what was the main motivation for this podcast and why you wanted to kind of do this?
The main motivation for me is, I think, especially after I had experienced the accident. My mum was amazing at kind of creating a support system for us. And she was learning about so much to do with grief and trauma and loss.
Yeah.
And she would read all these amazing books on how to grieve. And for me, I would, you know, always look at them and try to pick them up, but they just weren't very, like, I couldn't really identify with them. And so after a while, I just thought, God, I feel so isolated and so alone. And suddenly I was, you know, on the same playing field as everyone else, but carrying, you know, so much more baggage. And so I think in general, with a lot of young people, there aren't really like enough resources or tools out there to help a young person navigate life after a challenge. So essentially, I just want to create a safe space for people to come when they feel alone or when they feel a bit isolated and just a bit overwhelmed, because challenges, you know, take on all different forms. They can be big, they can be small. But if anyone just feels a bit overwhelmed and isolated, they can come here and kind of have a bit of a breather. Feel that they can have someone to relate to
100%
as well.
Relate. I think that's the biggest thing. I think, I mean, I've spoken on this podcast before about grief as well. And I think my number one thing was until I met someone else who had been, who had lost a parent as well, I really, like, It was such an eye-opening experience because I think my whole life, and I'm sure you felt the same, it's just so isolating, isn't it? And so it's, we just want this to be a place where people can go, no matter what challenges they face in their life, to feel like, I'm not alone. There are other people out there going through something similar. And even one step further than that, this is what I can do if I need advice, or this is where I can go. And so that's,
And we want to provide an educational space as well.
Like,
we're going to have some really interesting people come on so we can have, you know, a lot more tools in your toolbox, as my mum likes to say.
100%. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about kind of your life and your story. As you've mentioned, you've experienced a lot of adversity and trauma, and it's what makes you who you are today. But as a goal of this podcast is to shed a light on these challenges, we thought we'd start from the beginning. So can you tell us a little bit more about your visual impairment, first of all, and how it affects you day to day?
Yeah, so I am an albino, so I have nystagmus and astigmatism, which basically means that my eyes move. I have this thing called, like, I like to call it dancing eyes. Mm-hmm. So they kind of will wobble back and forth. And then also I have an interned eye. Essentially, I can see the details in your face perfectly clear, but I wouldn't be able to read, like, I don't know, the title on that book, for example.
Right. Is it like distances as well?
Yeah. So it's short-sighted. So, yeah, the main problem that I face is with reading and also with albinism. I can't develop pigment in my skin or my hair and also my eyes. So, I've been born with it. You know, it's not, to me, it's not essentially, it's not extremely debilitating because it's all that I've ever known. But I think growing up, it was, you know, a much bigger issue for me because I didn't know how to handle it or I didn't know how to navigate life with it. But, yeah, it means that in life I won't be able to drive. Which means I do luckily get free public transport, which is a massive help when you're living in London.
So as you've obviously dealt with this for so long, I think you've come to a place where your life just is what it is with the visual impairments.
Yeah.
And like you've said, you kind of, you know what you have to do. Like in work, for example, you've got, you know, things you do differently or the screen a bit bigger or, you know, things that you need to do at a certain time of the day.
Yeah.
But for others who are dealing with this maybe for the first time or who are quite young and feel really out of place or like they don't really belong, what's your advice?
I'd say my first port of call would definitely be don't make yourself smaller for anyone. I think for so long with my albinism, I was just terrified of people seeing the true me. And I, like, for example, I was so scared to leave the house because I was, you know, I'd put a hat and sunglasses on because if I'd walk out, I'd be nervous that I'd get like people jeers or joking at me or like people staring at me. And then eventually I was like, actually, like, this is my life. I should not have to deal with this from anyone. It's, you know, it's no one else's business what I look like. But that definitely took a while. And, you know, I still go out at night and I'll have, you know, some men make weird jokes about my eyes, calling me cross-eyed and stuff. Yeah, it's bizarre. But on a similar note, not making myself feel small for a long time as well. At uni, for example, and at school, I was so reluctant to use, like, things that had been given to me to help with my eyesight, like at school, which I think is where a lot of my kind of self-consciousness started with my albinism, because everyone else had like the normal school desks. And then to help with my eyesight, I had a big like teacher's desk up at the front with a sloping writing desk, a magnifying glass, and a laptop that connected to the whiteboard, which I am now, I am so grateful for. But at the time, I was so embarrassed and so shame, like I felt so much shame because I just was so different to everyone else. And what I would have given if I could turn back time now, I would have just told myself, do not be embarrassed. Yeah. Like, just accept this help because it is going to take you so much further if you just accept it and use it to the best ability. And so now when I work, like, you'll see I have like a raising laptop stand, which is a lifesaver. I think anyone, even if you haven't got bad eyesight, you should use them because your neck will thank you so much. But at the same time, like in airports, for example, I'll, you know, take photos of the gate or I'll ask people for help. I think asking people for help is, you know, it can be quite intimidating, but it is a really, really, you know, easy thing to do and it does help. But yeah, taking photos of the things that you can't see, I think if you're visually impaired, is also a really, really helpful thing to do.
I think that's really interesting what you said about asking people for help, because I think one thing as well with visual impairments, I think people sometimes don't notice or know that you're going through that. And I think a lot of people, like, I would never know that that would be an issue for you. So I think this is why this conversation and these kind of conversations generally are really important, because I think until someone hears about it, they don't really know about it. Do you know what I mean?
No, I know what you mean. There's so much thoughts and chatter around it. Like for me, for example, at the end of the day, because with albinism, we tend to get tired quite quickly because because our muscles are straining so much to focus. You know, at the end of the day, your eyes do move a lot and your eye does get more turned in. And I remember when I first started at Sheerlarks, before I knew everyone and felt like comfortable,
yeah.
I was so nervous at the end of the day because I was like, oh, I can't look at people because they're going to see my eye and think that there's something up. But I think definitely that's a really important thing, like time, like want to give yourself enough time to settle into things. Like I, for myself, know even if I didn't have a disability, even if I hadn't gone through the accident, I'm a person that it takes me quite a long time to settle into things. And I think especially having a visual impairment, I need to be aware before I start something that it's okay if things don't go amazing straight away. You just need to give yourself time and give yourself grace and just settle into it a lot.
Yeah.
So I think that really helped me as soon as I
like, also think that what you were saying about communication is really important. On one side of it, you know, people should really get more acquainted with these things and know more about what people are going through. But at the same time, I think when you're starting a job or if you're at uni or if you're at school, just talking to the people around you and telling them what you're going through, I think that will make people a lot more susceptible to helping. And like, because I think that once people know what you're going through, they're going to be like, yeah, of course, what can I do to help? That's so interesting. Like, like, can you, like, will this help? Will that help? And I think sometimes people are embarrassed almost to to say that. And that I think that applies itself to all things, whether it's a disability or to grief. I think having that communication, it's so hard because you don't want to feel like you're, you know, you're getting pity from someone or you're anything like that.
God,
but I think it does really, you kind of just have to be like, you know what, this is my life and I'm going to make it easier for myself by telling the people around me what's going on.
I remember, because it is like, before I started telling everyone, it was, in my head, it was such an awkward conversation. And I remember at uni, it would happen throughout the whole experience. Like, I just, because I'm so, like, my eyesight is so bad. I would walk down the street and people would, like, wave at me and I, you know, straight past them, like, would not see them at all. And they'd be like, oh my God, like, I'm just being so rude. And I'm like, no, literally just couldn't see you. And then as soon as I felt comfortable enough to start talking to them about it, being like, no, the reason I couldn't see you is because, you know, I have this visual impairment. Yeah. And there was such a weight that was lifted off my shoulders because at the end of the day, no one then turned around and was like, okay, well, I'm not going to be friends with you because of that. Like, no one, if they're a good friend, no one's going to say that.
And if they do, just
and if they
be
do,
friends
then
with them.
They're not friends,
yeah.
But, yeah, then eventually, you know, one of the main jokes, like, around me is, you know, we joke about my eyes and we joke about my eyesight and it actually makes me feel so much better because it doesn't make me feel left out. It doesn't make me feel different. It just makes me feel like I have this thing that's fully accepted by my group. And it's just part of me.
Yeah.
And it's a funny part of me sometimes because sometimes I do really funny things because I can't see.
That's, I really like that. And also I think with that, do you have any advice for friends who are trying to support someone with something like this? Is there something, any advice you'd give from experiences you've had?
I think asking questions is always, you know, a good idea. If you can see that they're struggling on a certain day with whatever they have going on, I just think do speak up. It's never going to hurt if you do speak up. And I know it feels so uncomfortable because you're worried about the response that they're going to give and you're worried that it's going to be, you know, a really emotional response and you're not equipped for that. But it means the world to someone if you just say, you know, oh, you know, are your eyes hurting a bit today? Or like, are you feeling okay today? Are you feeling a bit overwhelmed, overstimulated? What's going on?
Yeah.
I think that is vital. And also just not tiptoeing around it because we already feel isolated enough. Like we've already got something going on that we don't really feel like we can share. But if we have people saying, actually, you know, like, give me the nitty gritty of it, you know, that's, you know, let's not beat around the bush here. It makes you feel so much better.
That's really good advice. Yeah. So obviously, like we mentioned before, another really significant topic that we want to touch on is grief and trauma and loss. Like you mentioned, back in 2013, your family was rocked by a very traumatic accident. Your mum is joining the episode later on actually to talk a little bit more about this and the effects it had on your family. But first, could you talk a little bit about what happened?
So when I was 12, we were on our speedboat in Padstow, which where we go every year, and we always, you know, we always used to play this game where we'd like go fishing and then we'd come back and we'd like jump over the waves as we came back. And my dad said, there were six of us on the boat. There was my mum, my dad, my two sisters, my brother and I. He said, do you want to go around? Like, should we do another turn? And we were like, yeah, like, let's do it, of course. And then, yeah, we turned. To this day, no one really knows what happened. I mean, there was an inquiry, but I've, you know, kind of taken myself out of that narrative. I don't really want to know. But I think it was a mixture of, you know, too fast a turn and the choppy water. And yeah, the boat span out of control and we all got chucked out the boat. And then I just remember seeing the boat, you know, speeding off and seeing us all in the water and just thinking, okay, like the boat's gone off. We just need to swim to shore. And then, and I thought Dad was still on the boat for some reason. And then I saw Dad in the water, realised he wasn't. And then I saw the boat start to turn. And because my dad wasn't wearing the kill cord, so usually when you wear the kill cord, the boat automatically stops. And so he wasn't wearing it. And I saw the boat turn around and I was like, okay, like this isn't good. And then, yeah, the boat started spinning in circles. We kind of were all trapped in the middle of it. And then my mum lost her leg, sadly. My brother found, like, we managed to save his leg. He had 26 operations, I think, to save his leg. But he was such a champ. He was 4 at the time. And my little sister, Emily, she was 8. She died, sadly. The boat had gone round a few times. I had been hit, which affected my hand, and I have like a scar on my leg. So I wasn't hit, you know, that badly. I came out of it quite well. But after I got hit, I kind of, you know, opened my eyes and looked up and I saw my dad in the wake, and then the boat came round, hit him. And so swam up to him, and I had heard, it's really weird how the survival instinct kicks in, because I think I had heard somewhere at school, I think it was just like a rumor that apparently when you die, you have brain activity.
Right.
And I, you know, I knew he was dead from the get-go. It was, you know, very obvious that he was gone. So I just kept speaking to him and just kept making sure he was okay. Yeah. And then I saw the kayak had turned up, and this is where it gets, it's actually really, like, I can laugh about it now. But basically, the couple who turned up on the kayak, it was apparently, it was the boyfriend's first ever time riding a kayak. So he's rocked up to this situation being oh my God, what have I... And I'm swimming there with Dad. I'm like holding Dad, swimming to the kayak. And he's like, what have I just walked into?
Oh God.
But no, so I brought him to the kayak. And then they were like, no, like he's gone. You have to leave him. So I said goodbye and pushed him away. And then we got rescued by the boat. There were these like rescue boats in Cornwall called Thunder and Jaws. So they rescued us, took us to Padstow, where there was like a whole swarm of people there. And then eventually we all got put in different ambulances. And I remember at the time, it was really funny when we were all wearing, you know, like how Hollister was all the rave back then, like Hollister and Jack Wills were like, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I remember a few days before we went down to Cornwall, my mum had bought all of us, you know, like matching Hollister, like kitted out Hollister outfits. And we were like, oh my God, like we're so fashionable now. And obviously because I was covered in water, like I was soaking wet, they needed to like cut off my clothes and wrap me in like a tinfoil blanket.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you. And the doctors were like attending to me and I freaked out. I was like, no, don't you dare cut my clothes off. They're new, they're brand new.
My Hollister clothes.
Like, don't do this. Like, this is the worst. Which I think they're all looking at me being like, who is this girl? Like, what is going on? But yeah, eventually made my way to the hospital and then, yeah, stayed there for, I think it was 2 weeks. My mum was in hospital for much longer.
Because of her leg.
Yeah, because of her leg. But my sister got off, you know, she wasn't hit at all. But she was literally my rock throughout the whole thing. Like, I think she had a lot of shock, obviously. But she literally spent every day with me. We were in twin beds in the hospital. We found out that my sister had died because we all thought initially that my sister had gone to a different hospital. They had all told us, like, she's in a different hospital. I think she's gone to one in, like, Devon or something. Mm. And then eventually they came in and said, we're really sorry to tell you, but your little sister Emily has died. And yeah, after that, I think the shock blanket really set in. Mm-hmm. And it was all just very hazy from there. I remember the accident, like, clear as day. I can remember, you know, almost everything very, like, I remember our parking ticket ran out at 4:06 p.m. Like, it's really weird how you remember the little things. But, yeah, I think the shock blanket is, for me personally, I don't know how you feel about it, but I think the shock blanket is a lifesaver. I'm a big believer in the shock blanket being a lifesaver, because after your mum died, what was your experience with the shock blanket?
I think it was very similar for me. I think I remember the day that I found out, mm-hmm. and it was a slightly obviously different experience. She had cancer and she was ill for a long time. But I think with that, I never thought anything was going to happen. Yeah. I think I was quite naive, as I was quite young as well. I was 14. But I think it's, that time period afterwards, mm-hmm. it's all a blur. It's all such a blur. I don't remember much of it. And I think that's kind of also what I wanted to talk to you about. I think grief really changes with age and it changes with time. And I think at the time, like for me at least, I think I was so young. I just wanted to get back to school. I just wanted to be normal. I didn't want to be talking about it. I didn't want anyone to ask me about it. It was kind of like what you were saying about your visual impairment. I was so embarrassed. Like my number one thing that brought me anxiety was someone was going to ask me about my mum, or like ask me like, oh, so what does your mum do? And to have to tell them like, oh, she's passed away. Like it was the number one thing that would like stress me out. And I'm sure you feel the same, only because you don't want other people to pity you. Yeah. Or feel awkward. It's like, even today, it's like something that really gets me.
What do you do when someone says to you today, like, oh, what does your mum do?
Oh, I honestly, I'm like, I get so awkward about it, but I'm just like, oh, she passed away when I was younger. Yeah. And then it's kind of the after of that, of like, you just don't want someone to not know what to say or feel awkward about it. But I think it is one of those things I'm sure a lot of people who've experienced grief go through, but it's just one of those things.
I remember my sister, still to this day, when someone asks her,
you tell me this,
oh my god, she is very, you know, to the point, very blunt. She hates any sort of pity. And so if someone asks her if dad's died or if Emily's died, if someone asks her what my dad does, she'll literally be like, oh, he's retired. And I'm really, like, Liv, you can't say that to people. Like, come on. And then they'll find out later and it'll just be awkward. But I think going back to the shock blanket, I think agreed, like for me, after it was a complete blur and it was all just very hazy.
Yeah.
And I think it's so vital, because it does, like, if I didn't have the shock blanket, I don't know who I would have been today. I think, you know, the wave of emotion and like raw, intense emotion would have just completely taken over my life.
For those who aren't sure what that means, what is the shock blanket? Like, what does that essentially mean?
So shock blanket is basically after you go through a traumatic situation, you know, it doesn't have to revolve around, you know, loss or grief. It could just be any traumatic situation. Your body kind of goes into this mode where it kind of, I don't know the best way to describe it, but it just does kind of like shut down any form of like intense emotion. That, for my experience, it was, you know, a complete, it was kind of like no thoughts. Like, just,
it's like the way your body helps you kind of get through it in the moment. It's kind of like when something happens and you're like, adrenaline kicks in. It's like, it's just your body's way of like protecting you almost. Yeah,
exactly. I remember literally a few hours after the accident happened, I was getting prepped for surgery. And it is so weird the way that it works, because I was sitting there like chatting away to the nurses, you know, happy as Larry. Like, you wouldn't have thought anything had happened. And I had forgotten that the accident had happened. And I was there, you know, smiling, chatting. And then I was like, oh, God, you know, I feel really, really tired. And the nurse was like, yeah, you've had a pretty big day. Yeah. Like, that's no surprise. And then I realized, I was like, oh, yeah. Like, but I didn't feel intensely sad about it at the moment, and that carried on for a few months. I think I don't know about you, but the shock blanket for me wore off, I'd say, like a good few months after the accident happened. Was it similar for you?
I think it came in waves for me. It was, I think I really distracted myself a lot with school and what was going on, and then there'd be moments where I'd be alone and I'd be like, ah, shit, okay, right, let's go out. We're gonna do something. And I think it was in such a time in my life, like I was 14 turning 15, like that's such a pivotal age of like growing up, and like, so I think it was just a time where I was just very much distract. But then I think especially in the last few years and in my 20s, it's really, it's come back. It's come back, and it's really, and it, that's, I think, something that a lot of people find. So for you, what were the kind of longer term effects of your grief, or like how has it kind of changed?
I think with grief, sometimes what happens is there are people that, like you and me, distract, yeah. kind of do as many things as they can to not mm-hmm. think about it. And then I personally think I'm quite good at letting my grief out. My sister, for example, she'll hate me for saying this, but she does bottle her grief up a right. lot. And then once, you know, a year or like once a few times a year, she will just burst into tears and explode with yeah. it. And I think for me, my grief changed in the fact that when I was in year eight and the shot blanket had worn off, I was at school and there are a few girls at school that didn't really, because they wouldn't know. Like, there's nothing wrong with them for saying it because they wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah.
But they would say, like, you know, like, just move on. Like, it's happened. Like, it yeah. was ages ago. And I think that made me, I was already really, really angry at the situation because I was like, why has this happened? I was, you know, in a really like, why has this happened to me? This is so unfair. Yeah. So I really developed a lot of anger. And I know yeah. people talk a lot about the five stages of grief.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I ever went through denial or bargaining, maybe, but anger for me was a lot yeah. of it. And as I've grown up, I think an analogy that I really, really like to use with grief is for kids. I don't know if you can relate to mm-hmm. this, but kids going through grief, it's kind of like jumping in and out of puddles.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be, you know, on the trampoline laughing, you know, happy as Larry, like feeling quite, you know, secure and feeling great, and then you'll jump into a puddle and then suddenly the grief will hit you.
Yeah.
And you'll be fully immersed in it. It'll be very intense. You'll yeah. be crying, and then you'll be out the puddle again and you're, you know, yeah. back to school, you're feeling great. But for adults, grief is more like a flowing river. So you're always stood in this river.
Yeah.
And sometimes the water level is higher and your grief is more intense. And sometimes the water level is shallow and it's more bearable. But it is always, I think, as always an adult, there. What I've learned is, for me, it's always there.
Yeah, 100% agree. Yeah. I think it's a lot more, not constant, because that, mm-hmm. I think, like you said, it comes in waves now.
Exactly,
and it's
yeah.
sort of, you know, it's always there, but it, mm-hmm. then there's times it will really
yeah.
hit you, and times it's sort of like, I know it's there, and yeah, I'm getting on with my life, but it's yeah. there, and it's part of life.
It's
and,
part of me as yeah, well.
Yeah, exactly. But that's really interesting what you were saying about school, and I think that is something that makes it so different mm-hmm. from if you've lost, you know, a partner or someone when you're older
yeah.
or you've lost a parent. I think that, and it's not anyone's fault because everyone's young at that point
yeah.
and, you know, it's hard to relate and it's hard for people to understand if
yeah.
you haven't been through it. But do you have any advice for younger people who are going through something like
yeah.
that? And, you know, people, perhaps they don't have that support system at mm-hmm. school. What's helped you, I guess?
I think for school, I did have some amazing, amazing friends. As you said, with embarrassment, I was so embarrassed and I didn't want pity. But then sometimes I just needed a hug.
Yeah.
And so I had a few friends that just instantly knew. My secondary school friends experienced it with me. They were there mm-hmm. the whole time. They would send me letters when I was in hospital. They were there when I came back to school. So they kind of knew what to do straight
yeah.
away. If I was crying, they'd take me into the bathroom and they'd help me. And we'd just cry together and sort
yeah.
it out. So I think for younger kids, if you're still at school, secondary school and primary school, just know that it's always really important to ask questions. I cannot reiterate this enough. I think asking questions and just checking in on how someone's doing, it doesn't have to be an intense way, like sit them down being like, are you okay?
Mm.
It would make it slightly normalized.
Yeah.
Like just be like, oh, like, are you missing your dad today? Or like,
yeah.
how are you feeling about your dad today? Just make it normalized, make it light, make it bearable for them, I think.
Yeah, that's really good advice.
It's really important. And then for adults, I'd say, because I definitely, when I got to uni, my grief, like that's when I really, really started to struggle. And I think a lot of my uni experience until third year, I did not, you know, talk to anyone about my grief. Like I was so mortified about it. And I remember every year the accident anniversary would come up and I had like a few friends, one of my gorgeous friends, Ali, would bring me flowers every year and we'd all go to a bit of the pub and celebrate it. And I just remember being so, I didn't want to be a burden to anyone. I remember I had a boyfriend that was like, I know it's the anniversary today. Like, I'm going to be here if you need anything.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm absolutely fine. Like, don't talk to me. Like, I'm completely fine. Obviously I wasn't, but yeah. I was just burying it so deep.
Yeah.
And I think my friends in third year started to realize, because I then got diagnosed with PTSD
mm-hmm.
and also OCD. And I'd struggled with OCD for years. I do think I probably had OCD before the accident,
mm-hmm.
but OCD may have been a byproduct of my PTSD.
And how does it manifest for you?
I had, you know, awful, awful nightmares. Mm. And then towards uni, I didn't really struggle with it that much throughout the rest of secondary school, but uni, it was like constant flashbacks. Like I'd be at the pub and everyone would be having a great time and then I'd have a flashback.
Yeah.
Like I would see a bit of water or something and I'd just be like, water, okay, think about this like graphic scene. It was so twisted because I wanted to keep my dad's memory alive so much. And I wanted people to remember that he, you know, wasn't taken by, you know, by choice. He was taken from me. And I was so angry about it still that I would kind of bully myself into remembering it and bullying myself into remembering, you know, the graphic scene, which made my PTSD worse. Because I think with PTSD, often you can get really, really irritable and you can feel a lot of guilt. And I definitely felt so much guilt. I felt guilt for still being there. I felt guilt for the what ifs. I felt guilt saying I should have, you know, said no to the boat turning around. I should have dragged Emily with me and made sure she didn't get hit. And then another aspect of my PTSD that I really struggle with is sleep. Mm-hmm. I think anyone who does experience PTSD knows that like sleep is a massive part that's affected by it. And yeah, for me, that has been, I think, probably the biggest struggle out of everything for me. Like, not out of my whole grief, but out of a lot of things, my sleep has been so deeply affected by it, whether it's from a nightmare, whether it's trying to get sleep and just thinking like about the what ifs, and also just overthinking about everything in life. Because another product of PTSD is you get very tense and you get very on your guard about everything.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends, I had a family friend come up to me when we were in Portugal, we were swimming, and she was saying, God, Amber, like, I do love you, but you do immediately think of the worst case scenario for everything. And my friends always say, you know, you're so dramatic. And it's funny until I deep it and I'm like, actually,
There's a reason
why I act like this.
No, I really relate to that, yeah.
Do you get what I mean? It's like, we have gone through something and there's no telling whether something like that can happen again.
Yeah. No, for me, I've got anxiety disorder. So I only recently, like in the last few years, actually was like diagnosed with that. And it made so much sense. Like when they're like, this is why. I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. The reason I think about every like possible outcome for every situation is because when something really traumatic happens, you then think, right, I'm going to protect myself by thinking of every like outcome that could happen with any situation.
Any situation.
And I totally get that, like, I think a lot of people don't deep it as much and they just think, oh, you're such an overthinker or you're such a this or that. And it's not their fault. Like, it makes sense.
Because they don't understand.
No, they don't.
Overthinker is such an annoying term to me. Oh, my God. Like, literally, we're in the trenches here.
Yeah,
like, we are just trying to get through it. But it is. It's your brain's way of protecting yourself.
100%. And, you know, it's exhausting. And through like therapy, I've realized that just because that's true doesn't mean it's okay. Like, you do have to work through that. You do have to like stop yourself. You have to do things to make sure that you're not doing that, because it is draining to go through that every time you think of anything. Yeah. But at the same time, it's good for people to know that that's, you know, it's not just not just being the drama.
We're not the drama, guys. No, we're not the drama. But I agree. I think, and also if people say something about your behavior that you don't agree with because you know that it's something that you're subconsciously doing to protect yourself, speak up about it and just say, actually, and you don't need to make a whole song and dance about it, but just say, actually, the reason why I'm acting like this is because I have been through something and it's my brain's way of coping with it. I kind of learned that in therapy very recently, actually. It's been so beneficial. I know therapy isn't like accessible for everyone, but I do urge anyone. They have amazing therapy on the NHS.
Yeah.
It is so vital. And there are so many different forms, whether it's CBT, whether it's person-centered. I think it is, for me, I have person-centered therapy and I just go in there and I rant. And if sometimes I don't want to talk about anything deep, then I'll go in and say what really pissed me off that week. Like, I'll be like, oh my God, my friends were so annoying this week. Or like, oh, you know, I was really stressed out at work this week. Mm-hmm. But then if I do want to go in and say, actually, I've been really struggling with grief today, I want to talk about Emily.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it just, it's like going into one of those anger rooms and just smashing everything. It kind of resets your nervous system a bit.
Yeah.
So I find that really, really helpful.
Yeah. And for people who are thinking, you know, how do you get into therapy? Mm-hmm. I went through the NHS. So my advice is you can refer yourself. So you don't have to go to a GP first and speak to them. And then, you know, you can email directly to your local council that has like your where your NHS is.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, you can go into CBT, which is typically what you'd probably be referred into. And I just think, you know, a lot of people obviously avoid it because of the cost. And I totally agree with that. That's why I went through the NHS. Mm. But they are really helpful. It's a set number of sessions which can be increased or you can do less. And it's fully up to you. Yeah. And at the end, if you do want to continue, you can go into private, you can be referred into other help. And I do think that if you're thinking about doing it, it's as much as the waiting lists are long.
Yeah.
Just do it, because I think if you're struggling with anything, it's such a big help. Just to give you, like you said, it's that toolkit. It's to give you the tools to, even if you're not going to do it for the rest of your life, you do six sessions and it maybe equips you for anything that you're dealing with, to deal with it in a different way or to look at it in a different way.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Amber, for sharing your story and your advice. And I think that'll come up a lot more throughout these episodes. Mm. But moving on, you're now going to speak to your mum and go into a little bit more detail about advice and kind of the effects on your family. So they're going to discuss the effects of grief on a family, how they supported one another, and advice for other families and young grievers. So I'll pass it over to you guys.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.